This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague and friend, Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, an Australian national, and we're going to Australia. There is a proposal called AUKUS underway in the United Kingdom, in Australia, and in the United States. The part that is underway now is the thinking about Pillar One, that is, transferring both the technology and initially a submarine of the Virginia class to Australia to run, to be maintained on patrol out of Western Australia. Fremantle is the name of the port near Perth, Western Australia. However, there is a Pillar Two. There's much more ahead of us because this is more than just a military alliance. This is also a technology alliance. I note that in the news from Australia recently were three senior officers of the Royal Australian Navy who had just graduated from a class teaching them how to run a nuclear submarine engine, how to drive a nuclear submarine. Gregory, Pillar One, that is underway right now, and you've identified the three countries working together, but there is politics here. Is there any doubt of in the three countries? The United Kingdom is about to go through an election, is generally understood, a general election. Australia went through a general election and has a new prime minister who is not at all, not as martial as he might be. And the United States, well, you know that. It's topsy-turvy. So is there any political hesitation on AUKUS? Good evening again.
Good evening, John. Yes, there is hesitation about AUKUS. Firstly, created politically in the United States where there's a resistance to actually providing Virginia-class submarines out of the U.S. Navy fleet allowing Australia to get its fleet built up using the basis of maybe up to three already serving U.S. Navy Virginia-class vessels, and then for Australia to buy an additional two new-build Virginias. There's a lobby in the United States which says that the U.S. Can't afford to divert its submarine building base to provide these vessels. This is pretty hard to believe when you think that the Australians are going to be paying full price for all of these projects, plus a lot of investment in the U.S. Defense industrial base. But what we do see in the latest defense budget is no real provision for this expansion of Virginia-class construction to enable the release of operational Virginia-class USN vessels to the Royal Australian Navy. So that's one problem. Another problem is that the UK will continue with creating a new submarine to replace its present Astute-class attack submarines, nuclear attack submarines, with a vessel which is now being called AUKUS SSN or ASSN. Now, the problem is that the Astute class is running into some difficulty technologically, and there's going to be some delay and increases in cost in the Astute SSN, which Australia planned to build. So what we have is this highly complicated and literally unworkable situation where Australia would get, over the life, five Virginia-class SSNs and then five to eight AUKUS SSNs, some of which would be built in the UK and some which would be built in Australia. At the end of the day, we would see a period where Australia was operating the conventional Collins-class submarines, which it now has, which are very, very good, then some Virginias, and then one or two AUKUS vessels, all at the same time, with very different training, manning, and supply chain requirements. So this is becoming unworkable, and we're seeing the cost blowout in this going, you know, over the life of these vessels, you know, maybe into almost $1 trillion, close to $1 trillion. And this is going to distort, no matter which way you look at it, it's going to distort the Australian defence budget, disproportionately taking funds away from other services, or the defence budget will have to be increased even more dramatically. And it's already significantly over 2%. And that we don't even know whether that's going to be sustained. So you've got a situation where the likelihood of completing Tier 1 of the AUKUS agreements is in doubt. The Royal Australian Navy may not even have that kind of requirement for such a fleet. We're talking about eventually having a fleet of 12 nuclear attack submarines, which is a pretty big fleet to buy and to man. And right now they're having manpower problems because they can't recruit enough people. And we're also seeing that these are going to come in to service in the late 2030s, mostly in the 2040s and 2050s, when we don't even know what the world strategic framework will look like or where the technology will be.
Well, let's turn and to that. Let's turn to that, because implicit in what you're saying is this is not thinking squarely about the threat from the PRC, if I read you correctly. The PRC is not the only threat in the neighborhood, and also the PRC is an immediate threat, and the transfer of the SSNs to Australia, does that answer the immediate threat?
No, because they won't come in time anyway. The first SSNs from the US will not come until the 2030s, by which stage we will have seen either attack between the West and the PRC, or we'll have seen the PRC collapse as a viable strategic threat to the US or the region. And we're already seeing that collapse in the People's Republic of China, largely based on the absolute implosion of the economy, which is now underway. And we're seeing the fragility of the People's Liberation Army in all areas, but particularly the PLA Navy, really being apparent. The PLA Navy is not going to be the threat we thought it was, largely because of the way they've built their vessels and are training their crews. They won't get the money. We're already seeing a situation where the PLA leadership itself is very much at odds with Xi Jinping, and Xi Jinping will either collapse as the leader within a short space of time, or the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Communist Party of China, if it wishes to survive, will need either to corral Xi Jinping into a corner and not let him make the decisions he's been making, or the Communist Party itself will collapse. So we're looking at the prospects of any or all of these sorts of things emerging. So in a sense, the Australian nuclear attack fleet, which is perhaps a desirable thing to have, is going to be a fleet geared towards a post-China world. And that probably means having to deal with the Indian Navy and the Indian Defence Forces, because India is a rising power in the region and does claim dominance over the Indian Ocean, and that's contested by Australia and by the US and other powers, and by Russia's operations in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. So we're looking at, okay, what's the threat likely to be post-China? Secondly, what's the technology likely to be post-China? Can we deal with these threats and the changing environment by using lower-cost, remotely operated unmanned underwater vehicles, just as we're starting to do with unmanned aerial vehicles? And Australia is actually well advanced on the development of heavy underwater unmanned submarines, which can be used for offensive warfare. So it may be that the SSN will be like the battleship after World War II, not even the battleship in 1942 when it was knocked out of effectiveness, largely in most naval operations in the Atlantic and the Pacific.
One detail about Australia, you write that it's at a pivotal point in its history. Is Australia having the debate that we're seeing in Europe and in the United States, that we need to reawaken the industrial base? Is that going on in Canberra?
It's not going on in Canberra, but it's going on in the rest of Australia, and it's been underway for many years. When I was growing up there, mixed up with the aviation and maritime industries in particular, you had a country that could build complete aircraft platforms. It was an advanced avionics and the like, advanced naval capabilities and the manufacture of naval combatants. Australia built, on two occasions, the world's fastest piston engine fighter, the world's fastest climbed a height jet fighter in the world. It was able to do these things from its own base. Now it's a subcontractor to US and European companies, and successive Australian governments have sold off this autonomous Australian defense industrial base to foreign governments. So you've got BAE, for example, a British-based global defence company, owning a lot of the Australian defence industry. Thales from France owning more. Boeing and Lockheed Martin dominating the local industry. So essentially, we've had successive Australian governments take away from the control of Australia's own technology thinking, when they should have been enhancing it, because Australia did have such an enormous capabilities after World War One and after World War Two, and basically stood them down when London and Washington said, "Oh, we don't need that anymore. You can all go back and play football again." So,
let me go to one other capital that's in question now. That's London. There is an election imminent. We're told it could be as soon as May. The Labour Party is in a very strong position, according to the polls. Is there any reason to believe the Labour Party would turn its back on AUKUS?
No, I don't think so. I think this is something which appeals to British governments of both major parties. So I don't think that's likely to be a problem. I think we would see a weakening of Britain's defence commitment overall, and I think that is a problem. And it's already been weakened dramatically, even by the Conservative governments, who one would have expected to have committed to a greater expansion of defence technology and defence autonomy. That hasn't happened, not to the degree necessary. And Labour would be reduced again, as we expected to be in Australia. I think that if we saw this Australian Labour government re-elected, we would start to see them reneging on their commitments to spend 2.5-3% of GDP on defence. And I think in Britain we'd see that. So it's not an optimistic sign if you're looking for a viable defence industrial base, either in Australia or the United Kingdom.
And let's check on the United States. We have an election. Everybody can see that the choices are between two men who associate themselves with national defence. Is there anything to choose between them? AUKUS was under Mr. Trump's administration, I believe, and it's continued under Mr. Biden's administration. Is it all the same for them?
No, I believe that AUKUS is very much a secondary or tertiary consideration for the Biden administration. They like the fact that Australia is an ally, but that's about it. I think that if we saw the Trump administration return, we would see a greater commitment to improvement in the efficiency and capabilities of the US defense industrial base quite dramatically. In all of the countries, UK, Australia, and the United States, we're seeing massive inefficiencies in defense spending, largely as a result of over-consolidation.
Gregory Copley, Defense and Foreign Affairs, updating us on AUKUS, which is a grand idea. It just needs to be pulled together by successive governments over the next 70 years. We're going to our favorite moment of the week, the King Charles III Report. Gregory Copley, I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.